You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. State Attorney General Josh Call is running for a second term leading the Department of Justice. His Republican challenger is Fond du Lac County District Attorney Eric Toney. This week's Central Time is talking with both candidates about the major justice issues in the state. Tomorrow at this time, Eric Toney will be with us. Right now, Democratic incumbent Josh Call joins the show. Attorney General Call, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with a question of Wisconsin's 1849 law banning almost all abortions. Your Department of Justice filed suit to block that law, citing more recent legislation that appears to allow some forms of abortion. Can you remind us why you chose to file that suit?
Well, first, we've begun to see the harmful consequences of the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe versus Wade. There was a 10-year-old rape victim in Ohio who had to travel to Indiana to get the health care that she needed. Here in Wisconsin, a woman who had a partial miscarriage was left to bleed for 10 days before a doctor could intervene. I heard from an OBGYN who told me that when people come in with planned pregnancies, which are usually the most joyous appointments she has, and I remember those appointments with my kids, she said now sometimes parents come in and they're terrified about what's going to happen if there's a complication they weren't expecting. And the idea that families have to worry that if they get pregnant, that could end up leaving kids at home without a parent, it's wrong. And that is not the way that our system should be here in Wisconsin. So 4 days after Roe was overturned, I filed suit seeking to block enforcement of Wisconsin's 19th century abortion ban. I've also been clear that we're not going to divert resources from investigating and prosecuting the most serious crimes in the state to going after people for abortions. But that's a huge differentiator in the AG's race. My opponent has repeatedly pledged to enforce that ban. He won't rule out enforcement in cases involving rape or incest. And he's even suggested that we empower DAs to prosecute abortion cases across county lines. That is wrong, it's backwards, and it shouldn't be the way we move forward in Wisconsin.
If the 1849 law is in effect, I mean, isn't it in your purview as Attorney General to enforce that law? Even if you don't make it a top priority, wouldn't you be expected to coordinate with local law enforcement and prosecutors to enforce the existing law?
Any prosecuting or investigating agency has limited resources, and we make judgments all the time about how to use those resources most effectively. And we at DOJ in particular have statutory authority to investigate crimes of statewide importance. That's what the statutes say. We investigate homicides, sex offenses, drug trafficking cases, and we put people who've committed serious crimes behind bars. It will never be the case that it is an effective use of our resources to divert resources from those other purposes to go after people for abortions under this 19th century ban.
Speaking of violent crime, we saw an uptick in violent crime around the country, Wisconsin no exception, most notably related to gun homicides. What steps are you taking related to violent crime, and would you take if you were reelected?
You know, I'm a former federal prosecutor. I prosecuted murderers, gang members, and drug traffickers in one of the most violent cities in the country. And as AG, I oversee a Department of Justice that investigates and prosecutes some of our most serious crimes. We need to continue to have an AG who has that kind of experience. But we've also got to invest in public safety in Wisconsin. Our public safety has been underfunded for decades now. Shared revenue, which is one of the sources of money that local governments use to fund local law enforcement and other critical services, has declined while costs have gone up. So a year ago, I proposed a Safer Wisconsin plan, which would invest $115 million into public safety through community policing, violence prevention efforts, law enforcement, recruitment, retention, and wellness programs, victim services, and other steps. We need to have solutions for funding public safety. I've proposed them. My opponent hasn't. We also need some common sense gun safety measures like universal background checks. It's not okay to have a system where people can sell guns out of the trunk of their car without having background checks conducted. But my opponent has not supported those kinds of measures. And then we also need to strengthen our bail system so that if people are a danger to the community, they don't get a certain amount of bail that they can potentially make and get out if they're a drug kingpin or a wealthy. Instead, they should simply be detained pending trial if they're a danger to the community.
Those last two changes you mentioned are not things an attorney general can do on their own. How would you work with the legislature currently led by Republicans, quite possibly led by Republicans, in the event that you're reelected to try to make those background checks happen and make those bail changes?
Yeah, all three of those really require legislative action, and we're going to keep advocating for those kinds of investments. I put out my Safer Wisconsin plan a year ago, and the legislature, unfortunately, hasn't taken action. But I think that voters are going to send a message at the polls in a week. And I think one of the things that is going to be clear is that Wisconsinites want those kinds of investments in safer communities. We worked during my first term in office to get things passed that make our communities safer. We reformed our sexual assault kit laws so that kits get submitted, and ultimately the legislature passed that. They created about 70 additional assistant DA positions around the state. They invested in law enforcement training, and those are all things that I advocated for as AG. And we're going to keep advocating for investment. We have a huge surplus right now, a record-breaking surplus, and investing a portion of that into safer communities, given the challenges that communities across, not only across Wisconsin, but across the country are facing in the wake of the pandemic, is a wise investment, and it's one that I'm going to be advocating for the legislature to make.
Talking to Attorney General Josh Call about his re-election campaign. Attorney General Call, your opponent Eric Toney has pointed out a slowdown in the last several years of DNA evidence processing. Turnaround time on that evidence has been about double what it was, as I understand it, since 2018, even though you're getting fewer of these cases coming in. Why is that?
There are a couple of things that are happening, and the bottom line is that we are on the right track with the crime labs, and things have improved. So first, the number of DNA cases that are awaiting testing by the crime labs has dropped significantly during my time in office. And that, to me, is the key metric, because those are the cases where prosecutors or investigators are waiting to get results. And once they get those results, they can move forward. So as the number of those cases drops, there are fewer cases where prosecutors and investigators are waiting. It is true that we have made the testing process more complex by adopting probabilistic genotyping. That process takes longer than the process that was previously used, but it's an incredibly worthwhile investment, because that process allows us to get DNA results in more cases, so we can solve more cases by using that system. It's true that it takes longer, but despite that, we've seen the number of cases drop. And we've also seen the number of cases awaiting DNA testing drop despite the impacts of the pandemic. So we are on the right track. We do need to get more resources. We've gotten under half of the resources we've requested for the crime labs, but we're going to keep advocating for those resources so that we can continue moving forward in the work that we're doing.
On the show recently, we've talked about PFAS pollution in communities around the state in groundwater, well water, and elsewhere. You're part of a lawsuit against chemical companies who manufacture that so-called forever chemicals. What are you hoping to accomplish?
Well, first and foremost, I think everybody in Wisconsin should have access to safe and clean drinking water. Nobody should have to worry about giving their kids the water from the tap. They shouldn't have to worry that they might themselves have illnesses because of the water that they drank in Wisconsin growing up. But unfortunately, because of PFAS's link to all sorts of negative health outcomes, there are communities in the state where that's not the case. I was in Marinette in late 2019, and I heard from people who didn't feel comfortable giving their kids the water from the tap, who were worried about the health consequences that people they went to high school with had suffered, and whether that was because of PFAS contamination. And so the principle I take to this is, first, if our laws are violated, polluters need to be held accountable, and we need to make sure we are getting these toxic chemicals out of our water. And it's the companies that made millions of dollars in profits that should be paying for that, not taxpayers in Wisconsin. So we filed a suit against PFAS manufacturers and marketers. We also filed a suit in connection with PFAS contamination in the Marinette area. And I've been committed to ensuring that we're getting accountability. My opponent has been much weaker in terms of talking about holding polluters accountable. He recently reported that he had received a $10,000 contribution from Coke Pack. And they're, among other things, have been against environmental enforcement. So it's a very clear difference on this issue in the AG's race.
Finally, one job that attorneys general around the country get involved in a lot is lawsuits at the federal level. Republicans often lining up on one side, Democrats on another. When do you think it's appropriate to bring Wisconsin into challenges on one side or the other to the federal government?
There are two things that I've looked at throughout my administration in deciding when we get involved in a lawsuit. Number one, is there a strong legal basis for the challenge that could be brought? And number two, is that challenge in the interests of Wisconsinites? When both of those standards are met, we have gotten involved. And so as an example, there were a number of efforts during the Trump administration to roll back policies that were in place that helped fight climate change or protect clean water. We were involved in a number of cases challenging those policies, and we were largely successful. When the Postal Service tried to slow down the mail prior to the 2020 presidential election, which could have caused people to be disenfranchised because their ballots weren't received in time, we joined other states in a multi-state lawsuit in that case as well. So to me, those are the two critical issues, when it's in the interest of Wisconsinites and when we've got a strong legal challenge.
Attorney General Call, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Call is the Democratic State Attorney General running for a second term. Tomorrow at this time, we'll talk with his Republican challenger, Fond du Lac County District Attorney Eric Toney. Coming up, around 650 geographic sites around the country were recently renamed, dropping references to a slur for Indigenous women. We'll learn about some of the new names here in Wisconsin and get a perspective on what these changes mean. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The U.S. Interior Department established a derogatory names task force last year, which has been identifying geographic feature names under federal use that ought to be renamed. The department recently released its full list of around 650 renamed sites around the country, including 28 here in Wisconsin, that used to include a slur for Indigenous women. A lot of the sites are water-related, creeks, rivers, lakes, and an island. Oneida Nation responded to the department's move with a press release in which Vice Chairman Brandon Yellowbird Stevens said, quote, "This has been a long time coming, and it shouldn't have to take the first female Native American Secretary of the Interior to do something that's morally and ethically just." Barbara Webster is Director of Public Relations for Oneida Nation. Bobby, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Can you talk about just how widespread this particular slur has been, maybe still is today, in place names and elsewhere?
Well, I think it was pretty well understood and known throughout the entire United States that it was a derogatory term. However, that didn't stop people from using it, and it became sort of a term that people felt was a way to identify and thereby named lakes, islands, streams, mountains, different things within the entire environment were reflected by that name.
And so having all these creeks and rivers and lakes in Wisconsin and elsewhere that have this slur toward Native American women in particular, if I can ask, what was it like for you as a Native American woman to see and hear those names out there?
Well, it's hurtful and it's disrespectful and it's a show of ignorance and the lack of having any appreciation for the diverse cultures that are represented across the Great Turtle Island. But more than ever, it was accepted and it was just overlooked. And to be in that frame of reference that just overlooks a complete way of recognizing Indigenous women is just intolerable.
I had that quote earlier from the Oneida Nation press release saying, you know, great, but it's a long time coming. Why did it take this long? Do you have some thoughts on why it took so long to get here?
Well, a lot of it had to do with oppression and genocide and somewhat assimilation by Indigenous people to, expect that human nature is not going to exchange something that's negative and hurtful. So there was a lot of trust through generations that Indigenous women, Indigenous people, felt that the interaction between the different cultures would be mutually respect. But as it turned out, by time I think Indigenous people got a grasp of the English language, it was too late to understand the damage that was being done and the genocide that we were a part of.
We were talking to Barbara Webster, Director of Public Relations for Oneida Nation, talking about a change in place names, replacing a slur directed at Native American women in particular on a lot of places around the country, including a couple dozen here in Wisconsin, a lot of waterways in particular. Bobby, as you look at the new names around the state, this was an opportunity to correct this wrong in the past. What do you think of what's come out of that now with the new names? It's an opportunity to... I guess, bring new and better attention to these places.
Well, I'm not real well versed in what some of those names have changed to. I know some of them have changed that are totally different from an environmental concept. So it may not be relative to any of the Indigenous lands that are around it. It might have changed to a family name of a non-Indigenous family that lived in that area. So it may have changed the name of the lake to Jones Lake or something like that. I really can't comment too much on how the names change to reflect any of the environment or what they are. I don't know what they've been changed to.
Sure. Now, this is a process. It took a while. Are you hoping that this is a first step? Are there other changes that you hope people consider either on federal land, which this applied to, or state or local land as well?
Well, absolutely. I think the change should be global. The sentiment of a derogatory term reflecting any type of land, city, lake, or any place in our environment is just not appropriate. It's very disrespectful. And I think that goes to any culture, not just Indigenous people, but we should be reflecting positive and beautiful things when we talk about our environment and when we identify them by naming them. It should not be in any respect derogatory to any culture.
Now, we're talking about place names here, the S word we're talking about. Is that something that in conversation and talking to people, you run into people using the phrase either intentionally, hurtfully, or just not knowing its history? Is this something you run into just in your daily life?
Not anymore. When I was a schoolgirl going to elementary school, I heard the name. I've been called that name. I heard other young students use that term. But after growing up and getting into high school, I don't believe I had heard it beyond high school. And I'm 69 years old, so it's been a while since I've been in school. But when I was very young, I did hear the term, and I didn't understand exactly how derogatory it was based on mostly the tone of how it was used. So, you know, when they referred to you as ignorant or stupid or dirty, then you certainly knew what they were talking about and got this negative connotation, but I've not heard that term in probably the last 20 years. Although I know it was used at the boat landings during the fishing controversy in the Northern Woods.
Do you see this as a symbolic improvement, or do you see, like, is that change you've experienced in your life? Do you see it as a symbol of either, I don't know, other improvements, or maybe at least the potential for more improvements in the future?
I think we've come a long way, but there's still a lot of room for improvement. We would hope that our children in school are not mindful of these kinds of terms and that derogatory way of referring to anybody. You always want your children to have a better life than you had. So I'm sure that each generation will begin, and I hope and pray that each generation will begin to undo the damages that were done for many, many years of assimilation, genocide, and oppression, and that we continue to move towards cultural appreciation and mutual respect.
Barbara, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Been talking to Barbara Webster, Director of Public Relations for Oneida Nation. We talked to her today about a recent effort by the Department of the Interior to change geographic place names, including 28 around Wisconsin that used to include a slur directed at Indigenous women. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll look at an environmental story with a good outcome and find out how global changes helped stop the ozone hole in the Earth's atmosphere. And we'll find out how a massive epidemic from 7 centuries ago helped shape our DNA today. It turns out that the Black Plague, the bubonic plague that swept through Europe in the 1300s, may have links to some autoimmune conditions that we may experience here in 2022. And a preview of this week's Food Friday. I'm hoping to get the word out early to see if we can find some stories from the pasta makers of Wisconsin and beyond. We're going to talk about making our own pasta. Easy ways to do it, fancier ways to do it. And if you are a pasta creator yourself, want to hear from you right now. What got you started making your own? Do you have a fancy machine or you do it, what, just roll it out and use a knife to cut it up? I don't know much about pasta making. Maybe you can tell. Want to hear your pasta making stories? Get us started on Food Friday right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Let us know a favorite recipe that you might have. Let us know about your biggest pasta fail. And we can talk about it on the show coming up on Friday. Again, email ideas@WPR.org. Remember, you can check out great recipes all the time, anytime at WPR.org/Food Friday. Recipes from literally years of Food Friday conversations there. Most recently, some awesome cookies that'll be great for your upcoming holidays, maybe, and an arugula salad and a French lentil soup. Find that all at WPR.org/Food Friday. Coming up after the news, prominent public figures like the rapper formerly known as Kanye West have shared anti-Semitic views in recent weeks. We'll talk to a Wisconsin Jewish leader about the dangers of these incidents and how to push back against anti-Semitism. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, gross domestic product went up in the latest numbers, but is that enough to avoid a recession? Our next guest gives us insight on the new GDP report, plus the latest on inflation, employment, and interest rates. First, recent weeks have seen a rise of prominent figures sharing anti-Semitic views. The rapper Ye, formerly known as Kanye West, has posted anti-Jewish statements on social media and stood by those comments in interviews. His statements connect to anti-Jewish conspiracy theories, and some anti-Semitic hate groups have used his name in their propaganda. Some Republican candidates running for office in other states have been accused of anti-Semitic comments and ties to anti-Semitic figures, and in Wisconsin, UW-Madison and UW-LaCrosse have seen anti-Semitic vandalism on their campuses. This uptick in public anti-Semitism has Jewish leaders across the country worried about safety. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this a recent rise in public statements of anti-Semitism? Have you experienced yourself? Do you see possible ways to turn things around? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Miriam Rosenzweig is president and CEO of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation. Miriam, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. And thank you for having me on and bringing this issue to light with your viewers.
Now, Kanye West got a lot of attention after these comments, but you've been tracking concerns about rising public anti-Semitic actions and statements for some time now. What were you seeing before this all hit the headlines?
Well, we have seen through the work of the JCRC, the Jewish Council Relations Council, we have seen a steady rise of anti-Semitism and dramatically an increase since 2016. In fact, we've seen over 450% increase of anti-Semitic acts and an increase in the severity and violence of them over the last 6 years.
What kind of things are we talking about here? What kind of incidents are you most concerned about?
Well, the most obvious one that I could point to is that I never imagined that in my lifetime we would be talking about the safety and security of Jews in America. But just last week, we commemorated the four-year anniversary of the Tree of Life Synagogue massacre, mm-hmm. where 11 people's lives were taken simply for exercising their right to worship. And I think that in general, my concern is just the overall atmosphere that we're in. We are seeing this rise in anti-Semitism. We are seeing the rise in overall hate speech, in demonization of all minorities. And that is a very dangerous environment for all of us.
Something that struck me in long-term numbers from the Anti-Defamation League, when they survey the population as a whole about anti-Semitic stereotypes, they find a general decline in the population. But they're seeing the same things you're talking about with more severe, more public, more prominent acts of anti-Semitism. What do you think accounts for that, I don't know, that emergence of these public actions, even as maybe the general population is getting seeing less anti-Jewish sentiment?
Well, what's interesting is the other stat is that only 18% of the total incidents that occurred were reported by extremists, which means that 82% of them were done by regular people, someone on the spectrum that we would call normal. That is a great opportunity for education and change, but it also means that there are anti-Semitic tropes. And I will say again, I think it certainly bleeds out onto all other forms of hate that have been so ingrained and repeated that they've been normalized. And that only provides opportunity to reinforce those notions and those stereotypes and of the othering of different minority communities.
Now, when we see a public figure, a well-known musical artist like Kanye West, very publicly sharing these views, promoting conspiracy theories, targeting Jews, what kind of impact do you worry about?
Well, the first part of what was so dangerous about what Kanye did is that he's a public figure. Many people follow him, and he was playing into conspiracy theories that are so old, this notion that Jews have secret power and that Jews use it for evil to take down other people. And that is a uniquely Jewish stereotype and Jewish trope that has been used over the years. But with his influence and his ability to spread this message and then double down, we saw an immediate impact of that. You saw it a few days later with the signs over the highway in LA. We've seen it on our college campuses where we've seen Kanye was right. But I think the most disturbing part of Kanye's comments versus other anti-Semitic comments that we've heard is that he actually had a call to action and he had a call for violence against Jewish people. And I think that is really what set it apart from all other comments that we've heard over the last few years.
We're talking to Miriam Rosenzweig, president and CEO of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation, talking about anti-Semitism, more acts of anti-Semitic violence and statements, some from high-profile figures in pop culture and elsewhere. You can join in with your thoughts, your solutions, maybe your questions for our guest, your own personal experiences at 800-642-1234. How worried are you? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Miriam, a few moments ago, you mentioned the opportunity for education and outreach to the people who might not be, you know, hardcore members of a hate group. What kind of opportunities do you see there to reach out to them?
Well, I think we have a lot of opportunities. It's one of the distinctions of anti-Semitism that we see it on the political left and the political right. And then we see these messages being echoed out. But as I mentioned earlier, whenever you're looking at a rise in anti-Semitism, this should be a sign to us that things are going on, because I've never met someone who is vehemently anti-Semitic, but lover of all other minority groups and is welcoming and accepting of people who are not like them. The opportunity is to always come together to name when we see acts of prejudice, when we see acts of racism, when we see acts of anti-Semitism, to name it publicly, to educate, to come together and start shifting this trend of extremism that has been growing in our community. Now, there is all programming that is happening all year round, but I want to share the idea of community supporting each other. We saw this when the COVID vaccine came out, when the COVID virus came out, and there was a lot of anti-Asian hate. And it took communities that were outside of the Asian community to stand up and say, this is unacceptable. This is dangerous. And we had to stand together. And I think that's the opportunity here, is for the different groups to come together and say, this is not good for anyone. And that extremist rhetoric is intended to divide us. It is intended to other us, even within the different minority groups. There are incredible programs happening all around the city. We have a program with United Way that is called Partnership Milwaukee, Partnership MKE, in which leaders from different parts of the community come together to study the different demographics of the entire ecosystem of Milwaukee. And we learn about racism, and we learn about the impact of women in the workforce, and we learn about anti-Semitism, and we learn about the experiences of others, to humanize the experience, to know what to look for, and to become allies. There's a lot of work happening through schools, whether it is programmed through the JCRC called Hours Against Hate. We also have a Holocaust Education Resource Center that is helping with curriculums for utilizing the Holocaust to understand hate and to understand how other genocides came forth. And we also have a Jewish Museum of Milwaukee, which I invite everyone to come and to meet Jewish Milwaukee and Jewish Wisconsin, rather than just have a mythical figure that's coming out of stereotypes.
We're talking to Milwaukee Jewish Federation President and CEO Miriam Rosenzweig about high-profile cases of anti-Semitism, in some cases from prominent public figures. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen examples, concerns of anti-Semitism in your own community? What do you think of the response we've seen to Kanye West's anti-Semitic remarks and others out there? Do you have some kind of group in your community where people from, as Miriam was just saying, different backgrounds get together, learn about each other and the challenges you face, and maybe support one another? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Miriam Rosenzweig, President and CEO of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation, with us today to talk about recent anti-Semitic messaging from the rapper Ye, formerly Kanye West, and other prominent figures, how to push back against it, and wider concerns about anti-Semitism and how to prevent it, how to call it to account. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have if you're Jewish yourself? How are you dealing with the anti-Semitism you may be seeing in the news, maybe in your own community? What questions do you have for our guest? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Anita is with us in Lindenhurst, Illinois. Anita, hi.
Hi. I just had a question and a comment. My question, rather, is for Kanye, and does anyone really know how he developed his hatred for Jews, or did it come about with the advent of Pete Davidson? And my comment is that he should be educated to understand that at the beginning of the civil rights fight, that had it not been for the Jewish protesters and the Jewish people that supported, it wouldn't have gone nearly as well as it did. They were essential. And I'm not Jewish, but I was there. I saw it. And he really needs to dial it back and understand the actual history of civil rights and the part that the Jews played in it.
Anita, thanks for the call. Anita, pointing toward a point in history, Miriam, where you had that kind of mutual support you were talking about between two different groups.
Yeah, so first of all, I think it's important for us to name that the last thing that Kanye did was his anti-Semitic remarks, but he has said remarks that were very hurtful to the Black community. He has said remarks that have been very hurtful for minorities, and he has been growing this sort of ideology of his, and I can't specify for him, but I do know that there was a moment in time where our Jewish community and our Black community were much closer, and it was in the best interest of white supremacists to divide our communities and to instill notions of anti-Semitism or anti-Blackness within both communities. And it's something that we have to watch out for and come together and name that we are reinforcing the supremacist ideology when we hang on to the stereotypes of the other communities.
Anita, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Miriam, Anita brought up the source of Kanye's anti-Semitism. Now, there are a lot of conspiracy theories out there in the world. They're very prominent today, and so many different conspiracy theories end up either right at the outset or merging into anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. Can you talk about a little of the recent history of that?
Yeah, well, you know, I think you pointed to one of the distinctions of anti-Semitism versus other prejudice. Deborah Lipstadt, who is now the special envoy to monitor and combat anti-Semitism, she has a few criteria of what makes anti-Semitism a little bit different. And actually, her first one is this notion of conspiracy. It's this idea that there are culprits to blame for something that is threatening, and that those are subscribed to the Jewish community, something that's not familiar. We knew this over centuries. In the 1500s, the rumor was that the Jewish community started the Black Plague that took over Europe. And we saw that with COVID-19, where all of these conspiracies around the Jewish community and flyers blaming the Jewish community for these for this virus, for the vaccine, and for perpetuating it. You know, she says the other differentiator is that, unlike other prejudice, if we think about the hate that is spewed towards people of color in our community, it's really to push them down. It's to say that they are dehumanized, that they are not like us, that they are incapable. Whereas with anti-Semitism, it's often punching up, and it's sort of, you know, creating the Jew as more powerful and more educated and craftier. And they sound like, well, why would that be a bad thing to say that Jews are more educated? But the idea is that it all comes together in order to create this bad environment and do something bad to the non-Jew.
Thanks again, Anita.
So,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thanks again, Anita, for calling in at 800-642-1234. Talking to Miriam Rosenzweig, president and CEO of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation, talking about rising incidents of anti-Semitism and some high-profile comments from public figures, well-known, famous people. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, reactions, and comments. And speaking of reactions, Miriam, we saw, for example, the company Adidas, after a pause, cutting ties with Kanye West after these comments came out on social media and elsewhere. What do you think about that response? Companies in particular distancing themselves from high-profile figures who do things like this.
Well, I certainly think that it was a response to the public outcry, and I do think that it was greater because of the direct call for violence. But I would say that it's an opportunity for us to look and ask ourselves, why did it take this long, given the history of Kanye's words and viewpoints.
You mentioned some of your local efforts in the Milwaukee area. Are there things you'd like to see political figures across the spectrum do to try to turn the heat down here and try to discourage anti-Semitism?
Yes. The most important thing is that I would like to see corporations, government institutions include anti-Semitism in their DEI work. to not separate it and not dismiss it unless it gets to violence. And I think that would be the most important push that we would have in a call to policy, into looking at everyone's, all the programs that they put together, all the policies that they put together, and make sure that they are including anti-Semitism, including the Jewish community. I would also say that in Wisconsin, we have a smaller Jewish community than in some of the other states. And so I invite you to reach out to the Jewish Federation or the Jewish Museum or the Holocaust Education Resource Center or a JCRC, and we will happily come to you, whether you're a business or a school or an organization. If you want to learn about the Jewish community, if you want to learn about the rise of anti-Semitism, if you would love to learn about the many wonderful things that are happening in the Jewish community, we would love to be a resource.
What are you seeing here in Wisconsin in particular when it comes to anti-Semitic incidents and or encouraging signs from people, from other organizations in the state?
Well, we've seen a steady increase every year in anti-Semitic acts. And I will say, matching national trends, they are getting younger and younger. We used to be talking about only college campuses, and then we're talking about high schools. And now we're talking about events happening in middle schools. And that's coming from kids overhearing their parents. It's not because a seventh grader has inherently anti-Semitic thoughts. But just in the last few weeks, we've seen incidents in UW-Madison and in La Crosse. We have seen the Kenosha. There were flyers calling for conspiracy theories about the Jewish community and COVID. There were bricks thrown into a window in a Racine synagogue last month. And so we've just seen a lot happen. And at the same time, we have seen a outpouring of support when we reached out and to connect with the UW system, 50 organizations from across different parts of the Wisconsin fabric came together and stood with us. And the UW system was very responsive in wanting to continue the conversation and learn about the impact and the environment for students. So while there are really frightening numbers, we are seeing other groups and other communities come together and recognize that hate targeted against any group is detrimental to all of us.
One relatively new wrinkle in all of this is, of course, the internet and social media. Do you have thoughts for parents out there who don't want their kids to show up at middle school and high school spouting anti-Semitism or doing anti-Semitic graffiti, to help them avoid, you know, the cesspools of anti-Semitism and other hate on the internet, and to help inoculate them against that?
Well, if I could inoculate people against hate on social media, I would have many more answers in the world. I actually think that parents have to recognize that it's out there and that they can't shield their kids. And so really it's the conversations that they're bringing home and helping their children recognize what is hate speech, whether it's anti-Semitism or racism, anti-immigrant. I mean, pick the group, but it's really the same concept, teaching them how to filter through what they're seeing on social media, because we are no longer in a space where we could say that anybody is safe from that unless they're really not turning on any of the social media mediums.
Now, unfortunately, around election times in recent years, we've seen upticks in incidents of hate. What are you watching for now that we're a week out from Election Day? Do you have concerns?
Well, we always worry whenever there's social and economic turbulence. We tend to see a rise in anti-Semitism and anti-immigrants and any minority group. And so we are definitely watching it. And we have also watched the normalization of hate speech over the last few years. And that is most concerning to us. And we want to make sure that we are encouraging our communities to think about, when they're voting, not just to think about what their priorities are, but thinking about the community that we want to live in, the world that we want to live in. If we're only focusing on our own, we are going to end up more divided. And it plays into what the extremists want us to believe.
Miriam, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for shedding a light on this today.
That's Miriam Rosenzweig, president and CEO of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation, with us today to respond to recent examples of anti-Semitism from high-profile figures, including the rapper Ye, formerly known as Kanye West. Coming up after the news, are we experiencing economic growth or heading into a recession? We'll look at the latest increase in gross domestic product, plus inflation and employment numbers, and what they all mean for you. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.